Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld. On each week on this program, I try to bring the audience and the listeners new ideas about shifting paradigms, how to look at our world in different ways, how to expand our reality. I've been doing this program on BBS for the last 10 months and on my television show at newrealities.tv for the last 15 years. You can check that website, newrealities.tv, for a list of guests. And tonight, I have a very interesting guest, someone who will give me and the listeners a perspective that I've wanted in the context of this show of expanding realities. He's Dr. Frank Wildman. He's the director of the Feldenkrais Institute. He's an author, a lecturer, an international lecturer. He runs workshops and all sorts of information systems that he, I think has researched over the last 20 or 30 years, and he really is an expert on aspects of biology and the body-mind dimension. But tonight, we're really going to start, I think, from the beginning of the whole consciousness movement, and this will be kind of an overview of where it all began, where our whole listening perspective is coming from. Frank, are you there?
Yeah, I am there, Ellen. Hi, thank you.
And was that a fair introduction? No, maybe you'd like to reintroduce it.
No. I don't need to reintroduce myself. I think things will come out as they will as we discuss things. And yes, I think discussing, as we had mentioned earlier, you and I, aspects of the human potential movement and its origins would be an interesting topic, because potential is a very different meaning to many different people.
Well,
and
the
idea that there was a movement that labeled itself as such is something that some people consider wonderful and incredible, and other people sort of despise. So it's
they despise. We'll talk about both those sides. But as far as me and the program I've been doing and the research I've been investigating just on my own, I think this is a very important perspective you can give, because I just sort of stumbled upon it after college in the early 80s. What was I going to do with myself? I didn't want to go mainstream. I didn't like the paradigms that the corporate world or any of the things I was seeing were showing me about how to live in a society and how to contribute to the world. I couldn't find anything that fit who I felt I was until I stumbled upon what we're calling human potential. I think a lot of people of that, my generation, leaving college in the early 80s, late 70s, were disillusioned. But give us a little perspective on where that disillusionment and how people began to find an awareness of something else.
Yeah, well, I think there's a particular disillusionment that occurred before there was a disillusionment in America. Other countries had different ways of being disillusioned. And the human potential movement, and that a feeling of dissatisfaction, and I want more, I want something more and different.
Something
for myself.
Else. I grew up in the suburbs. My family was middle class. I had everything that I was supposed to grow up and want, and I already had that. So what was I going to do? Recreate what I already had? How ridiculous for me! So what was there? That's sort of where I was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people felt that way in cultures that were doing very well in terms of having comfortable middle class styles of life, and were becoming economically well off, at least viable, and within that, people get to question, don't they? They get to go, well, is this all there is? And what more could I have? What else do I do with my life? But what I already see is being the highest levels of potential or achievement in our culture, which might be a corporate kind of a thing or a professional class of some sort. And it's, it might be completely boring or never address your personal potentials, which a lot of people, I think, find out when they're children. They find out when they're infants and children what their potentials are, but then by having to pass through the standardization processes of school systems and the needs to measure, you know, how good you are.
Yeah.
Because of that kind of thing, a kid who's really good at music maybe never got to play music in any way because they just done his parents didn't buy him an interest instrument, and it just didn't work out, you know. So there's this latent musician, but it didn't work out that way, you know. And other people do get to live out certain parts of their potential. But this happened long ago in Europe because you had a combination in Central Europe of the this is after World War One.
Weren't there the Bohemians in the 1890s? Doesn't it go back sort of there to the?
I'm a full-blooded Czech myself, and I have a photograph of a fountain in Prague that still exists, and it's a round fountain with sort of layers of concentric rings of concrete and water, and people were laying around on this fountain strewn and draped with nothing on, right in the middle of the town, and you could see people in the back, and painters were circled around this round fountain painting all these people. Uh-huh. And in the background, you could see people shopping for bread and somebody pulling a cart along. It was just ordinary life.
Uh-huh. Right.
But you see, subcultures then are different. It's never, I think, fair to take what did one culture do at a certain time and what was, you know, what was arising out of the dissatisfaction that you expressed, which is a personal kind of satisfaction that I think a lot of people share.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to know, is that really what led to a certain kind of rise of movements that we affiliate with, in our minds at least, as human potential movements. I think the human potential movement really was ended up being very specifically American, although borrowed in some ways from the Weimar Republic, the era of in Germany and Austria and other parts of Central Europe, where concepts like exploring movement and exploring your body, rather than following regimen and standardization, because they
The Americans sort of borrowed the kind of, in a way, was inspired by the artists, like you said, then that kind of alternative lifestyle, and then it kind of came here, but you have also said it was actually the predecessor for this was the beat understanding. Now, how do we go from?
Most contemporary for us, and our first real subculture was a combination of black culture that played this strange music nobody else understood called jazz, and that kind of the music and the liveliness of that culture that was, after all, only recently a free culture. Mm. And that culture mixed into, in its own hidden ways, mixed into white culture, and then a group of people who wanted a really different kind of music and poetry and were willing to write a really different kind of music and poetry, like Allen Ginsberg in New York, Michael McClure out here in San Francisco at North Beach, Jack Kerouac on the road in between.
Right.
This began a subcultural movement.
What did they do that was so different than what was done before, in your understanding?
They were willing to live a lifestyle. I think that's an essential part of a subculture movement, is that you're willing to take a risk to live a lifestyle that is not ordinary,
mm-hmm.
where you're not where the fear of growing up and becoming one of the gray suits down the hall,
mm-hmm.
or
yeah.
a housewife in the bad sense of the term, meaning it's all the only aspiration that was thought of.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes like the end of the line, and you see the end of the line early on in your life.
Right.
And so it becomes something to fear. Mm-hmm. And most people prefer the security to the fear. So, you know, it's like, well, I'd rather settle for the security, and I'll feel less afraid. They go into those lifestyles. Mm-hmm. But then you have people who who decided they didn't want to go that direction. They were going to live differently. And that means differently in physical structures. It could be in communes. It could be sharing facilities in ways that, you know, nobody habitually did.
Yeah. Right, and then there's a sort of way of thinking about who they are in terms of their culture that seems to also change.
Right. Well, usually what becomes subcultural is and this part interests me a lot, is a particular feature that one can't identify at any given moment, and it's something that, for lack of a better word, I'm going to call hipness.
Okay.
And hipness is something that, in his honor, since he just died a few weeks ago, Norman Mailer tried to define best. Norman Mailer, the author.
Yeah.
And hipness is something that could take on many different forms at different decades. But it's a group of, that people just would look at something, listen to some kind of music, somebody dressed a certain way, and go, that's it. That's cool. That's hip. And we're going to do that. Or we're going to make more of that. And other people would go, what's that?
Right.
what about it? What's hip about it? I don't get it. You know, like, for example, today some people, you know, body piercings have passed in a way.
Right.
You know, like for a while there were body piercings were hip. But
right.
Why did body piercings become hip is a really interesting story, which I don't want to digress into. But
a little bit, because I could
that
never.
That was the thing to do. And now it's no longer the thing to do. Now the thing to do is branding. People are now branding themselves.
What do you mean, with like matches?
Like we have done in the past with animals.
Really? Is that the next hip thing?
That's a new hip thing. And it's like, and some people, you know, like it's hip, and they know it's hip, and that's the new thing to do.
Wow.
And if you're so outdated as to stay with tattoos, you know, then you're still, you just haven't quite gotten hip enough yet.
What's the thing that drives people?
Know that. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And the people who would like to know that the most, oddly enough, are the people who are farthest away from it all. They're the people who work in corporate boardrooms and are trying to figure out what to design and mass produce that people would buy.
That's a really funny paradox, that the people who want to know are the ones furthest away from knowing it.
Because they can't tell what's hip, they don't know what's hip. But all they know is that if they could figure out what it was and build it and mass produce it, they'd make a lot of money. So there's a certain odd alignment between what are hip people doing. And for example, for a while, Japanese teenage girls in Tokyo were the hippest people on earth.
Huh.
And people would go and see what would teenage girls in Japan dress like? What would they do? And they'd think of some crazy thing, and crazy meaning, you know, just some odd way of costuming themselves. And then they'd all dress that way very quickly, and it would become just the way that you were supposed to look, and then it would suddenly appear elsewhere and spread like some tremendous infection, you know? And people were madly trying to figure out how to design and create dresses that looked that way, because they would just cut things up and make them, you know?
Well, there's a whole movement of originality. I mean, actually, Shakespeare said fashion is the fashion, you know, back in that day. But, I mean, going back to, like, you know, Madonna was a trendsetter, or Elvis, or you know, if we go into cultural trends, there were world leaders like the Romans or the Greeks or the Byzantines. I mean, there's always been like a forward movement. Is that just the makeup of the human psyche? It seems like it is, to want
yes,
this novelty.
Yes, and sure, and it was the desire of a balding general called Caesar, who wanted to be paraded through town at his great triumph parades that they would have, and at his great triumph. He wanted to have something designed for his head that became the laurel wreath, because it was like a toupee. It was actually kind of like a designer toupee, made for the general who was going to be the monarch, and then that turned into the crown of thorns. So you can there's all these. That was amazing. How these things move.
But what is it about the human psyche you think that craves that kind of, originality and novelty, and then imitation? I mean, there's something in us that that wants to be hip, if you want to call it that.
Well, you know, I don't know if everybody wants to be hip. I don't think so. I think that that some people do, and some people couldn't. They just don't care about it. But it's an interesting thing in terms of how it's led, how it does lead to part of what's required to have a subculture. And
so going back to the human potential movement then,
yeah.
We had the kind of hipness of this originality, the jazz, the poetry, the stream of consciousness writing of Kerouac, that was all hip back then, right?
Oh yeah. And certain things certain kinds of books were very hip, and that was new. I mean, who knows what a hip book was, in the sense that we might mean, that's a cool thing, that's hip, like 100 years ago, 200 years ago. I don't know if there were books that would have been regarded that way, but they certainly became regarded that way by the middle of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
You know.
So then, what happened? Well, how did the Beats kind of migrate into the hippies, right? I mean, would you say that happened?
I think the Beats formed a famous enough subculture
uh-huh.
that although you know it got turned into Dobie Gillis on television,
right,
for mass culture. And they were considered sort of silly, you know, a little dopey. And
right.
that turned into something transformed by the political movements that came later because of Vietnam,
yeah.
and the integration of races, the civil rights movement,
right,
and in the culture and which. That therefore lent a certain unity to the expression of a certain kind of hipness,
uh-huh.
and then the most important perhaps is the mixture of various chemicals that entered people's brains and gave them opened the doors of perception.
Right, I was going to say that seemed like the thing that catapulted a new change in the world, the psychedelic revolution. You know the. Yeah, I think that was key to the...
There were several things, and I think that that's true because I think that part of the evolution of the brain depends upon what we ingest,
uh-huh.
and so I think it was that was very important, but also a chemical that was very important in part of that revolution was the birth control pill.
Oh yeah, in which way was that important?
Because it enabled men and women to behave in ways that wouldn't have been possible before without a tremendous amount of risk. You know,
so the sexual revolution was a big part of the open sexuality was a major part of the 60s revolution. That's what you're seeing. And still is seeing today. We're still living the kind of expression of that in many of our urban cultures, that sexual openness. I mean,
if you look at a certain line of the evolution of cultures,
yeah,
you could say each cultural idea, each true paradigm, if it really is a new reality paradigm, has moved us farther from God in any traditional sense.
Furthest from the traditional God. But maybe closer to a spirit, a pure spirit.
So, yes, something else. I mean, who knows what it will be or what it is. And it might be, you know, quite varied. But the unification of a culture can greatly resent the, for example, Galileo showing people that there were rings around Saturn and that you could see Jupiter and that these were planets and not stars.
Uh-huh.
And that the things way out there that we saw at night were stars. And they were a long way away and farther away than anybody said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was these kinds of ideas.
How does it move us further away from God? Because it seems like, the human potential movement, if we'll eventually get to that, is moving us closer to a sense of beingness.
Well, the idea that everything revolved around us. God made us, and God was very personal.
Mm-hmm.
God was personal for us, and most great ideas in physics have shown that. Well, look, unfortunately, we are a bunch of planets rotating around the sun. It's not the other way around. And not only that, there are many suns, and ours is just one. And they're at incredible distances apart, more than is imaginable, and or was in any religious writing. And then you have someone come along, and like Freud, who had said more than that there's an inside to meditate upon, but that this inside was based on family dynamics and family structures, and that there are very specific kinds of neuroses or behaviors, if you will, that could ensue as a result of certain interactions, and that your childhood was really important. That a child and the effects upon a child from the world around it could, in fact, determine what kind of an adult it might become. So you better be careful how you treat children, and like you almost should respect them as human beings. That was coming out of an era where children weren't really treated as, they were not quite, they were just little things to work. The more kids you had, the more you could raise them on the farm, you know, and do more. And it wasn't the idea of having a happy childhood or having the wonders of a children's life really wasn't around that much at the time.
So, well, that discovery of the unconscious or the effects on who we are growing up, that was an early 1900s paradigm shift, right?
Yeah.
Would you say? And that changed a lot in understanding who we are, and also set the groundwork in a way for what would become part of the human potential movement. Because then,
yes, and Freud daring to say that children had sexual feelings. This was something really, it was strongly anti-establishment, and of course it almost ruined the whole possibility of there being a kind of a Western version of psyche.
In what way?
You link psyche to childhood development, and that children had feelings of sensuality and then sexuality, and that matured as a child developed.
Well, how do you define psyche then? What's psyche?
I'm just using it in the classical sense, you know, the classical, more Greek sense, you know, which is a nice idea. Just, you know, this psyche, in a sense of almost like what then became the soul.
I see. Okay. Because, well, the fact that you brought up Freud, I mean, does bring up the fact that the 60s, besides being music and sex and psychedelics, was a whole psychoanalytical revolution with really radical people coming forward and redefining what psychology was. You know, people like Fritz Perls and Eric Fromm and R.D. Lang. These were radicals as much as any of the music and arts people were. Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah. I was very lucky because I got to study with a lot of these people.
Oh.
And I met Fritz Perls at a place called the Esalen Institute on the coast of California. And the idea of being here now, just be here now, and just say, what's on your mind now? Don't go into your childhood. Don't talk about the past or what they did to you. Yeah? And you like, whoever it was, teachers, it could have been anybody, what they did to you. You say, here's what I'm aware of now. Here's what I, you know, in that way, it seemed, because we didn't understand Buddhism, it seemed like Buddhism, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very much staying in the moment kind of an awareness that actually led to behavioral changes for people that were much more significant than the changes that they were doing in traditional forms of psychotherapy. And Will Schutz, who started to bring encounter groups out, he was my doctoral mentor, and he was from the Harvard psychology staff, And he came out to Esalen and observed that the implementation just felt the place worked better. Personally, for me, that led to a lot of things because I got to meet a lot of these people and study with them. But I also, he was the man who personally flew Moshe Feldenkrais, who had yet a more radical different view, out to the Esalen Institute and set him up to help be a leader in the new human potential movement.
Well, what was so radical about Feldenkrais? Because it obviously had a major influence on you because you're a Feldenkrais practitioner that travels the world.
I've trained hundreds of practitioners all over the world in 4-year-long training programs. So that's
what. But what was so radical?
Because he looked at things differently than at, like, say, psyche. He looked at the body, and in a way that most people hadn't. He looked at the body as in motion and realized that what stuck us in our life, what stopped us from developing our human potential, was habit. And that the hardest thing to do was to change habits. Mm-hmm. So at Esalen, for example, and then all over in the 80s, they started to have like drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs, and people started to realize that, gee, even famous people and celebrities and all, you know, people of all kinds of economic levels could become alcoholics, not just somebody, you know, the wino in the street image.
Right.
And
right.
And that they couldn't beat it either. They had a really hard time changing that habit.
Uh-huh.
So there was something physiological or body-based about it, not just psychological. And, you know, like, I'll use my willpower and overcome it. That worked for some people, but they were usually people that had a certain physiology and they could have, they could overcome it, they could stop. And then,
so that's what I notice about people who are addicts or even anorexic. I tell them, can't you just stop? And they obviously can't. And it's so hard for someone who doesn't have that to understand what it is in the body that compels people to habituate.
Well, I produce educational products in addition to programs, and one of the major product that was used in to try to stop the spread of cocaine in coke groups were Coke Enders was a big group, a nationwide group, and Coke Enders used to play my Feldenkrais lessons before each day, so people would get together, they'd have these encounter kinds of situations. And before they had their encounter group, their form of group therapy, they would listen to a lesson, which would put them in a certain physical mood, and then they'd just sit up and they'd start the day's therapy sessions.
Was it that you were doing with those?
Because it helped people to change habits. Habits as deep as the habits of how you breathe, the habits of your voice, the habits of your posture. The habits that are hard to change because we can't feel them. we don't have good enough access to them, so we don't notice them. We just know that we keep doing the same thing over and over again. And you know, some people discover towards the end of their life that, gee, I just married the fourth person, and they're still the same one.
Right. So, was he like the first person to discover that aspect of human potential and bring it out?
No, I think a lot of people, habit study and habit change and formation was something being done a lot by a lot of people at Stanford, at Harvard, and at other major universities. Paul Vitzlatsky at Stanford did a lot of work with it. But he was the first one to develop a system which was an attempt to change the how you did something when you moved, rather than like becoming more flexible or stronger or whatever it might be by repeating something, you know, and getting in shape. Mm-hmm. His interest was purely how could you observe something, change the way in which you did it so that you develop a skill. And in developing a skill, you change your habits. If you want to play a piano, you have to get over a lot of bad habits. You have to learn how to hold yourself differently, how to, you know, to be used. A lot of pianists get to the point where if they started off with bad habits in piano playing, they can progress no further until they change some of the foundations that they unfortunately learned incorrectly so that they can play better.
Well, in a more practical way, how could I or help people get over just lazy habits? They know they need to complete a project, and yet their habits, a way of living, are in the way of them doing what ultimately they want to do? What's a practical way to look at behavior?
Well, an important way that I learned to look at it was in Feldenkrais was the one who motivated me on this, was because I was looking at these kinds of issues from a psychological profession. My doctoral degree is in psychology, and so I looked at it from all kinds of points of view of motivation and the interferences with motivation. But what Feldenkrais did was he talked about it in a purely physical way, and what it was you had motives, which were desired actions. Mm-hmm. It could be even partially executed actions. You started to do something. You began.
Uh-huh.
But then you also had cross motivations. So forget resistances and all of that. Forget all the psychological issues went. And then what action do you do that would be a cross motivation to it? Because it could be that what you want is actually seen already by your unconscious is clearly not good for you. And so many things might develop that would be other activities. Like, for example, gee, I'd really like to read that book. That's a great book. That seems like a simple one. Well, I want to watch that program. It could be whatever, you know. I want to have sex with some beautiful man or woman I think I love.
Right.
And for some reason, it not only doesn't happen, but it continuously doesn't happen. I mean, it happens over and over again in life that kind of thing doesn't happen.
Right. So are we self-sabotaging, or what you just said, maybe it's not good for
you?
How do you know the difference?
We're not aware of what our other motivations are that work as cross purposes to our motivations. We have
what other motivations would there be to, like, reading a book? What?
Oh, some books. Reading a book, I sometimes think of as a good example, because actually books are dangerous devices, as the world has always known. When they tried to suppress the publication of a book, or burn books, or ban books. Books are dangerous. They can ignite the imagination. They can inspire the mind. People who read books cannot be controlled so easily. Right. Who knows what they'll think that we don't want them to think.
But if I want to read a book, and I'm just not getting around to it, what's going on for me?
Well, maybe you only think you want to read the book. And it serves you to have the illusion that you really want to read the book. Maybe what you really want is some sort of information that you think is in the book, but you don't want to go through the work to get it.
Uh-huh.
It could be that. That doesn't make you lazy.
Right.
You
so
know,
how do we get in touch with what we really want?
Well, I think that if people got in touch with what they really wanted at all times, you'd have a lot of very powerful people in the world. It might be just too much to live with.
Well, it would be a better world, though, perhaps. I mean, probably be a healthier world, a cleaner world, a more productive world, less suffering. I mean, that's where I think the human potential is empowering people to be more in control of their lives. I mean, that's the benefit of it. You know, that's what I think all these things like Feldenkrais and all the therapies that came out of the 60s, 70s, 80s are gearing people to get over those negative habits and live a fuller life. That's what it seems like, wouldn't you say that?
Well, here's two ideas, and these are ideas based on programs that I've developed and that are DVD products. One of them is called Your Brain is the Core of Strength and Stability. And that's simply an idea, a simple enough idea. It's movements you would learn that would put the brain in the body rather than here's some exercises to do that you don't really need a nervous system that's more sensitive for.
Uh-huh.
You know, here's things you'd need to feel and learn. And then when you feel them and learn them, your brain can learn how to control things and have you do things that would seem to take great strength and great stability. And so it's also physically a very, very useful program, and a program that Pilates and yoga instructors are interested in, and those kinds of things.
Well, what kind of movement would that be, like, for instance?
Oh, hard to describe, right?
Okay.
Because,
it might be a type of walking or moving
around.
It's
more how you do them, but it's learning how to do, starting with small movements and working through to larger movements, in a systematic way.
Go ahead.
And so what happens is, I've gotten feedback about the program, and so one of the feedback things, this woman came to me and said, well, I can tell you there's good news and bad news, and the good news is the program really works. I mean, after all the effort it took me to try to get stronger doing exercise systems like Pilates and yoga and da-da-da, this was so easy because I learned it and it was just easy to do. And I said, well, great, so what's the bad news? She says, well, the bad news is it really contradicts everything I realize that I believe about my life. I thought in order to get anywhere in life that what a person should do is work hard for it.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of just using your brain and doing it smarter and learning to do it smarter and make it easier to do things, it kind of contradicts everything that I've thought. And the whole idea of a heavy, sweaty workout sort of feels stupid now. Uh-huh. And it feels like I no longer enjoy myself working out as hard as I did because I actually don't see the point of it when I realize I can learn to do it. That was not. So then put another program, the same kind of idea. It was a completely different program, completely different construction. Is a program I have called under the Intelligent Body, Improving with Age. And so under the Improving with Age, I had a similar kind of feedback, a different kind of person. And this woman had really done a lot of things, achieved a lot at an older age after doing this program. But she felt bad about it. It was a part of her that her cross-motivation was attacked because she improved, but she had an image of being an old person. And the way she moved by the time she was done, she didn't move like an old person.
Huh.
And she felt that her friends would feel kind of negative towards her. She was afraid that they'd see her moving around so much more easily that they'd feel just less able in their own way.
Uh-huh.
So she didn't feel, she wanted to improve. That's why she got the program. But she didn't quite want to improve that much.
Or she could have shared it with her friends as well.
Yeah, no, I said, look, the best thing to do is get them all to do it, But she had a cross motivation because of society. There was a feeling that people might have about you shouldn't be doing those kinds of moving around that way. It's kind of like if you move your hips too much and since in Brazil you'll be fine. If you move them too much in Cincinnati, you might get arrested. That kind of thing.
Right. How do we find out about the WIC? How can we get the products? These products, because they sound amazing.
Well, they're very interesting products and very useful, and they're sold worldwide to a lot of people who are involved in many
different
things.
Is there a website or more?
People can go to www.feldenkraisinstitute.org. I better spell that. It's Feldenkrais is spelled FeldenKrais, and then Institute is, it's all one word. So Feldenkrais Institute is INSTITUTE and .org.
And under there's something called products that people would look at.
Well, there's a storefront that has several different things that they could do.
Okay, the programs and all that.
A book, and there's a couple of books on it.
What's some of the books you've written too?
Well, one book that seemed to be reasonably popular was a book called, it's from my press, it's the Intelligent Body Press, and it's The Busy Person's Guide to Easier Movement.
Uh-huh.
And it contains 50 short movement lessons that you could do while you're sitting at your desk, or take to work with you if you wanted to, and do something short that would use your brain. It would change your brain's way that you'd concentrate. Most people go a little mindless when they exercise, and this is like solving little puzzles in movement and moving while you do that, so that you feel better.
Huh.
And
if we get back to where we, it's interesting, all these side notes, but if we go back to the development of the human potential, how do you see that coming about out of what we described as the 60s? What What
you
was
mean
the
how
first?
The you mean the confluence of events?
Yeah, what happened?
I think that, you know, first of all, I think you have to have a country as wealthy as America was in the 60s. People,
yeah.
You know, don't realize we were wealthy. It was a wealthy country, of course, but I mean, there was a feeling of tremendous optimism and hope, and we were going to put a man on the moon in a few years, and then we did it, and you know, there was quite an attitude, but a lot of people felt, well, that's not what I want to do. That's not, you know, it's not speaking to me, and I think that there was a real draw to a different kind of a body image. A different image of what it meant to be embodied than a corporate look, or the way that a lot of people's neighbors felt, or the idea that if you really made it, you just sort of moved down the hall a little further to the corporate hallway higher up, and a lot of women were frustrated with what they saw was pretty much the same thing, you know, and they just, life was very prescribed.
Right.
And I think when you have, you know, that grounds, and you have the beat movement, and you have the kinds of medications, if you will, that became available, and you have music, and again, the civil rights movement, and the
woman's movement.
Full allowance of culture and the birth control pill, it all just, yeah, it was quite a catapult event. There was also a teacher of mine at the time who a lot of people might not think of as a member of the human potential movement, but he certainly was. His name is Marshall McLuhan.
Oh, yes, Marshall McLuhan, really. I love, what a genius that guy was. I mean, a lot of what you're saying reminds me of McLuhan in some ways. So, what was his big influence?
I studied with him, and he said something that at the time didn't make any sense to anyone. It would make sense to you if you realize, you know, you appreciate his genius, so this will sound not dumb to you, but a lot of people thought what I'm about to say was really dumb. What he said was, this was in the 50s, late 50s, he said, television is going to grow and expand far beyond what we see in front of us now. Mm-hmm. And it's going to change your children. And how it's going to change your children is it's going to convert them from what's now a visual culture, watching this tube, into a tactile culture.
Yeah, I've heard
that.
And he
said they'll become a tactile culture, and the way that they listen to sound will be different. They'll end up no longer touching each other while they dance. They'll dance separately. People will just stand and dance to music separately, which is how people dance to rock and roll later on, you know, entirely.
Right, but that's something other McLuhanists have said, because I've met a bunch of them in the media ecology movement. There's a guy named Bob Dobbs who was McLuhan's archivist. I haven't understood how television as a visual medium can have a tactile result. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. Because there's a way that people will even say, oh, man, you know, you turn on the television, you're like in touch with the world. You know, it's like, wow, you see all these things going on. You feel like you're in touch with the world, and it's visual. But people know from music, too, I think.
Sure.
You go to a movie, it just goes into you. It's like, wow, it can really, yeah, you feel that together.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it's different. I think the way that we go to movies has changed. You know, going to movies in Italy, you know, people will talk a lot during the movie and cry when there's a crying scene. It's, you know, it's very openly and expressive, and, you know, we tend not to do that as much. But he meant that eventually it would lead to a culture where everyone would have what they wanted visually in the way of information, not yet knowing, of course, that the internet would exist, that he didn't predict or know about. Almost all science fiction writers got that wrong too, but he felt that people would tactily fulfill their needs, and he predicted an era where, you know, nudity would become quite common, and people would want nude beaches, and this kind of thing would occur, and massage. the idea that you would, and that's the double meaning of his other one of his books, the message. I'm trying to remember the title of it.
The medium is the message.
The medium is the message, which is actually the medium is the message. It could be pronounced as, or the medium is the massage.
No, but I still don't get how these visual over stimulation is that it is part of this constant visual stimulation brought us back into wanting something more because we can only retreat back into our bodies because we are being invaded by the visual world in that way. Is there something about that he meant?
Well, yeah, a little bit. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wouldn't put it as strongly, but that would be a way of putting it. You know, that's a particular take on it, that we were being invaded by it.
Oh.
And in a way, we were, you know. And some people liked it, so again, they might not feel invaded by it. They enjoyed it. But,
well,
Tom
Wolfe, yeah, no, go ahead.
I mean, just, you know, he had his own conclusions from it were that it wasn't a negative thing or a positive thing. It was just that the result would be that the seeing of visual culture and the seeing of everything on television would lead to a different way that we'd see people in the real world and the way that we would end up making physical contact.
Mm.
I don't think that turned out to be true. I think that it was an incredible insight that definitely, I mean, his idea that how people would dance in the future was a wild notion, and that did turn out to be true. And yes, there certainly were more nude beaches and things like this, and people massage, and that whole idea, that did turn out to be true. But I don't think that turned out to be true for everybody, considering the number of people who watch TV. It was just a percentage.
Well, it did have an overall effect that, massage is no longer a bad word, yoga. It did have some type of effect. I mean, what I was going to say is that Tom Wolfe wrote a short story about Marshall McLuhan, and he brought him to a restaurant where the waitresses were topless. And it took McLuhan just a few seconds to size up the situation and said, they're not topless, they're wearing us.
Oh, it's great.
That's
great.
So I understand it from that perspective is that we are living inside the medium now, and that, the internet has taken over our minds, basically. We are totally living in a new paradigm because we are instant communication, what a friend of mine calls synthetic ESP, with everyone, everywhere, anytime, anywhere we want it. We are in constant contact with what McLuhan also called the global village. So, I mean,
the first to use that term.
Yeah, yeah, right.
He used the words, the global village. That became a popular new word, the new use of words, the global village.
And people thought it was ridiculous at the time he said it. They said, what are you talking about, global village?
I understand what he meant. And most of what he has now we think of is just it is a global village. He didn't even exist. He never even lived long enough to see how global the village would be,
But if you take the paradigm that McLuhan saw and the insight that he had, and we look at the human potential movement as it's sort of now intersecting with the internet, we are now evolving into a new phase of that potential. And how would you sum up where we're going now?
Well, if you look at the way McLuhan looked at it, always was like the automobile, and all mechanical things were an extension of our joints and bones.
Right.
He took it to the body, always. And he was very, very good at taking things to the body. That's why I see him in the human potential movement in that way. And so when he saw the computer as being core and what it would do, and electronic devices would be extensions in the same way as your car is an extension of your legs, it would be an extension of our brain.
Right.
And that what you'd be doing is interconnecting nervous systems. And so there would be a great interconnectivity of the brain on a global scale. And what that would lead to is to me, is very interesting, because I don't know what it's going to lead to, because I think it would take knowing ourselves in a way that we don't.
Uh-huh. But would you say we're moving...
Bedmobile means everybody. And what are people going to do? All I know is that history doesn't provide a very good... It's not a happy story.
Right.
Yet, so I hope that we learn things, and that people from the human, a new human potential movement, can learn things enough that they don't make the same tragic mistakes that have been made in the past.
Well, to sum up the human potential as you knew it, would you say it kind of coalesced in the 80s as a movement? Would you say when did it actually crystallize, the human potential as we know it? Was it kind of Werner Erhard's thing pulling it all together, or how did that come about? Because I want to see, you know, where we can say that we're going when we find out where it actually came into shape.
Yeah, I wish I could. I can't make that speculation on anything more than just really sounding off, because it's Werner Erhard used to come to my training program with Feldenkrais regularly, and he'd get lessons with Mache, and he was very interested in this particular work, and in fact he wanted to, in some way, I think he wanted to own it, but that didn't work, because Feldenkrais was far too academically minded a person.
It's great. I mean, you seem like you've known all these amazing people: Feldenkrais, Fritz Perls, Marshall McLuhan. Did you meet Marshall McLuhan?
I studied with Marshall McLuhan.
You actually? So you've met some amazing geniuses of our day that have lasting effects on the way we think as individuals and as a culture. What did these people have in common? What did you notice about them? Or they were all so unique that there was nothing in common.
I couldn't say that I noticed anything that much in common about them. I have a friend who I think of is really a bit of a genius in terms of these kinds of issues, and we talk about these potential futures a lot. And he put together a company called AgeWave, and because he was a science fiction. This is the guy's name is Ken Dykewald. He's actually quite well known. He wrote Body Mind back in the 70s, and it became it's made the word Body Mind popular. The book sold millions, and he left that world for a corporate world, and he started a corporation called AgeWave, because what he saw happening then in the 60s and 70s was the baby boomers. It's like, this group is all baby boomers, and someday they're all going to be old. They don't want to think about being old so much. The denial to see the obvious is so strong that all I have to do is open my eyes, look around, and like a science fiction writer, and all he liked to do is read science fiction, right? So think like a science fiction writer, and what would happen if you had just tens of millions of people and a burgeoning population moving through society like a wave, getting older, right? What would it be like? And his company turned out to be very successful. I sometimes identify with his point of view, because there is no way to really know too much about what that H-wave will bring. But we do know that from an evolutionary point of view, this is a perspective that I teach. I'm teaching courses on evolution, which I know we never had time to get to. But some other time maybe. But the thing that's right now on the planet is evolutionary. That's happening. That most people wouldn't think about when they want to think about the future is the fact that we have the largest number of tribal elders in proportion to younger people than has ever existed by far. It's so overwhelmingly large. There never was a society that could have imagined anything like this, and now that society, that unimaginable society, is here. And most of that society is educated and relatively affluent. I mean, there's a lot of poor older people, and like this, is a good percentage of them. But compared to how societies have been by the time you got older, it's a relatively affluent and has a tremendous amount of political power.
Uh-huh.
And what's going to happen as a result of that, we don't know.
Huh. But something will shift.
It's never happened before, you know? No other society. From tribal times on through the great eras of great societies in northern India and China, mm-hmm. and you know, in all of Western Europe and civilization, has never faced what's already here now.
Huh.
And so, what will that lead to?
And
I don't know, because the one thing I find interesting, everything seems, when I'm talking to people who are much younger than I am, I'm all 60, so 60 years old, and you're talking to somebody about something that you know a lot about, but they just look at their screen while they're talking to you and click on the internet and so the nature of knowledge is changing right in front of my eyes as I'm teaching.
Knowledge. So that must do something to the way we think, and when the way we think changes, the actual world is going to change, because invention then will take a different direction.
Mm.
It seems like, Terence McKenna says that 2012 will be a recapitulation of all of history. That was his prediction as we come down to the end of this Mayan calendar. And it already seems to have happened on YouTube. Anything that you ever wanted to know about the history of the world or media, it's right there on YouTube. And it's a revolution, a new revolution within the revolution of information technology. There's this additional subset that combines, what did McLuhan say? Where all media incorporates past media?
Mm-hmm.
That's where we are now. We're building.
It subsumes it.
Yeah.
But also, what I think is going to be interesting is that there is a huge gap between experience and in knowledge or information.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting because I use the internet all the time searching for things. Sometimes there's things that I know about in that way that one can only know about it because you've lived through it, or you've lived long enough to put more things together.
Mm.
And I realize I'll search really differently than people who are much younger than me. And I'll find out different answers.
Uh-huh.
And so how will that, eventually this will all come to be understood too, you know. That'll be interesting.
Well, in that way, would you say people are then using their bodies different because they are in touch with a different, present culture? How would you say they're using their bodies differently?
Well, I don't know, because we're all using our bodies differently.
Uh-huh.
You know, just some people grew up at a younger age starting to use their bodies differently, you know?
What you said before is that you've had more experience, which means, like, physically, you've been in the world, and it's different than someone who's just sat on the internet and kind of looked for information. You have more information within your body as a living, thinking entity than someone who doesn't have knowledge in their bodies in the same way, and therefore they must then have a different sense of body, is what I'm...
Well, so here's perhaps a difference in it. And we have to end this soon anyway, and so maybe this would be a way of drawing it together. I think a big difference is something like the word maturity.
Uh-huh.
Because one thing that happens as people get older, or doesn't happen, it might not, and it would happen to varying degrees. They get more mature or less mature.
Uh-huh.
And many people don't go early in their life, I want to be more mature when I grow up.
How do you define maturity?
Well, just I want to be more mature when I grow up. What does that mean?
Uh-huh.
What does that mean? And what's the meaning of it outside of a definition? We have a sense that a person, we hope that a politician, especially if they're in a powerful position, has approaches international situations of great complexity,
yeah,
with a mature point of view. you know, we hope that it's not going to be immature.
Well, I can't say that about myself. I thought I would be a lot more grown up at the what, however age I am. But, you know, I can understand that question.
I think it's a very complex word. You know, and I think it's a word that, I mean, there's been real ways to define it. One way Feldenkrais defined it was the ability to form new actions and reform new habits in the face of a changing environment. That works as a definition some of the time, but actually it doesn't say anything about the fact that you might deepen your understanding of something. So that what's interesting when I'm talking to students is they're so hip.
Yeah.
They understand whatever I might be talking about, and they can have conversations and carry it on almost to the point where I think, gee, I have nothing to teach them. Uh-huh. But it only takes, you know, after a while, I realize, oh, they understand the words to a certain level or in a certain way, but they don't really get the picture. They don't really get it.
Right.
And
yeah.
And so, you know, it's like this is a quandary parents have had forever with their teenage kids, you know. And like, the example I try to give people when I am in teaching situations is if you've ever had a talk with a really smart, really, really socially outgoing 5-year-old child who asks questions about sex.
Right.
You can talk about sex to a 5-year-old child, and they don't know what the heck you're talking about. But they
right.
can talk back to you articulately about it. They can
right.
carry on a conversation for half an hour about it. They can make jokes about it. They
right.
they get sexual puns. They
right.
get sexual innuendos. But actually, they don't know what it is at all.
Right, because they don't have the body experience, that knowing.
They don't have it at all. So it's like, so these words are understood and can be understood in sophisticated linguistic natures to get a pun or a joke. You know, it's not
yeah.
nature, but they really don't know what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And I do find sometimes there is that kind of strange gap that can exist
uh-huh.
about certain things, so that the internet will, you know, has a lot of information in it, and you can access a lot of things. But of course, we're limited by the fact that we can only understand out of anything that's organized in images or language what we already can understand.
Right. Right, because real wisdom comes from experience, is what a teacher I had said, you know. And it's when you have the experience, that physical sensation is the experience, is what the experience is. And with that becomes a deeper bodily, organic knowledge that we can then create further action from.
To take, you know, another example that I don't know it's appropriate on your program.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, there are groups that have been around years ago. A group that I knew was called Morehouse.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then there was a group that medically changed what Morehouse did and made it a medical kind of thing to help people have better sexual experiences, and in fact expand the nature of what one would consider to be a sexual experience.
Uh-huh.
And then that group passed on, and now there's a new group that called One Taste that has
right.
come up, and they're doing that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I realize, Guy, I've been around so long, it's and you wonder what the differences are and the similarities are. But you know, they all have a historical connection. But a lot of people don't know what their historical connections even are to things of the past anymore, and that happens in every culture.
Uh huh.
I work in Japan, and there are some Japanese kids who are bright. I shouldn't call them kids; they're older than that. Young adults in Japan who are taking training courses, and they're professionals in some way, in some area. They're already professionals. But they have such a limited knowledge of World War II that you realize, oh God, that's true. You could get away with that in America too. There are a lot of Americans
uh-huh.
don't really know anything about World War II or what happened. You know, it doesn't make any difference to them. They just don't. There's
right.
no, you know, it's like that was then and now is now, and That's how we are now.
But maybe that's the final question I can ask you. Is that important, or is it ultimately, I mean, history, I think, I mean, I'm fascinated by history from where we've come. Of course, George Bernard Shaw said, what we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. But I think we do.
Francis Fukuyama is I would describe him as an economist and political scientist, I guess would be the best way. Sort of a social economist.
Yeah.
He wrote a book a few years ago that was quite influential, actually, although he's retracted a lot of what he said in it. but he wanted to spring out a lot of ideas, and it was called The Body at the End of History.
Uh-huh. I heard about that. What did he mean by the end of history?
Well, he meant that we were approaching the end of history, that basically information was now soon going around so fast that whatever happened yesterday is today. And if it happened 100 years ago or yesterday or 1,000 years ago or yesterday, it made no difference. It would be right there at your fingertips. And so we were, as information gatherers, it was the end of hunting. It was the end of, that was part of what he meant. He meant a lot of things. It's kind of an interesting book. But
so then we become agricultural farmers of information, because
hunting and gathering. But then you have to realize, in terms of the population of the planet, most people don't have computers, and most people don't have any idea really what the internet is. And so there we are again about language, you know.
Uh-huh. And culture. Well, Frank, how can people find you and get in touch with you and find out where you're going to be?
Well, if people want to write me, they could just, they could just look me up on the internet just under Frank Wildman. I'm sure that they'll be able to.
Wildman.
That's through my name, yeah. Yeah, wow. Frank Wildman, like Wildman.
Uh-huh. And then the website is the Feldenkrais.
Website is but just Feldenkraisinstitute.org. One word, Feldenkrais Institute.
Right.
And we're
thanks. It's great to hear everything that you've accumulated as a body of knowledge, and all the people you've met, and how you've then brought it to a new way of understanding who we are as functional individuals in a culture. Are you writing about this understanding of culture and paradigm?
You know, I write things about it, but actually a book I'm working on right now that I have to finish soon is a book that's going to be called Change Your Age.
Change Your Age. Oh, yeah, we were going to do a show on that at some point, right?
And that's something that would certainly interest people, because it involves a lot of things.
Well, I will be in touch with. Thanks so much for taking the time. And,
but we should have a talk that would be interesting, just on evolution, biological, psychological evolution.
And then can we include the changing your age?
Yeah, we can include it in that, because the very notion of changing your age is that at one time wouldn't have been much of an idea, you know.
Well, I think that whole thing that you said your friend was developing, the age wave, is about tapping into this understanding of changing our age and a culture that desperately wants that. So the human potential is evolving into this next phase, and where it's unfolding, and maybe this is part of it, what you're contributing.
Well, I hope I'm contributing something. I think I have.
Well, you're a cultural historian. I mean, you are contributing your knowledge of this society's evolution. I think we'll always have history. We can't avoid it.
I think we always will, and I'm very curious to find out what history will be soon.
as George Bush said, the future will be better tomorrow, you know. So,
well, thank you very much for this interview, let's do this again at another time.
Yeah, thanks, and I'll just say goodbye and play this song. I'll play this song "Wild World" in honor of you. I just want to say to people, this is New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and if you have any questions about anything you've heard or comments, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com, or where I will have podcasts of this show and other shows. And my other television internet site is newrealities.tv. Thank you for listening. And here is...
Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll be in touch.
Bye-bye. Okay. Yeah.
Now that I've lost everything to you, you say you want to start something new. And it's breaking my heart, you're me. Maybe I'm grieving, but if you want to leave, take good care. Hope you have a lot of nice things to wear, and a lot of nice